The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Andy Marshall and I have read philosophy together for something like 4 years, and this week's episode is a recording of what was to be a discussion of Chapter 15 of Marx's Capital, Volume 1, but what turned into a debate about the difference between the natural sciences and social science, matter and mind, and knowledge and affect. Included in this conversation is a discussion of the labor theory of value and the reality of irrational numbers. It's Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you are a regular listener to this podcast, you can help spread the word about it by posting a review of the podcast in iTunes. Also, you might want to find the Zero Books Facebook page and or to follow us on Twitter. In this episode, you'll hear clips from a YouTube video on Pythagoras and behaviorism. Right now, you're listening to Clockworks by Mental Flux, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Andy Marshall and I debate Spinoza and thought. Clockworks will get inside your mind. There's a lot of history in this chapter, and I kind of was going through it looking for the arguments that had to do with the production of value.
The key is the footnote number 4. In that footnote, he talks about how Darwin is awesome, and he's awesome because he adds this historical approach to science or doing science. And he was greatly admiring that, and he thought, and Marx thought, that you could extend that historical process to political and economic things. And so this chapter is basically a book of itself. Like, it's the book he thinks should be written but has not yet been written. That footnote actually kind of gives you a framework as to why he's starting out talking about...
You know, the comparison between Darwin and this chapter of Marx's Capital is interesting. I mean, of course, Marx makes that comparison in a footnote, and he says something like, Darwin's given us this great book about the natural history of life and on the planet, and there's been no great book written about the, you know, actual human history of life on the planet and using the same materialist framework. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ought we not to have such a book? Because after all, while the natural history is not something that we've created, this human history is something that we've created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we should have... It should be easier and more helpful even to have a materialist accounting of it. But there's something really funny about that to me, that suggestion that we should have a materialist history of human history, since it's our own creation. The idea of a material history to me is synonymous with a natural history, and that once you go into the realm of human history as a created history, is something that the human imagination and human culture is producing, that the material side of it would seem to me to be diminished significantly, that you're no longer going to be able to account for history based on a strictly materialist reading of history, that you basically are going to have to approach this through some sort of philosophy of mind, I think, as well.
I've been reading a lot of Spinoza, and his contention is that, kind of against Descartes, is that there really is no difference between, like, mental and physical rights. And also he extends that argument, you know, in the ethics to that there is no human realm slash earthly realm, you know, that it's kind of all one thing, right?
Okay, but then that would be an argument, I would think, against something like free will and the idea that that humanity was creating history. Do you think that's true, or do you, is there still room for free will and human creation?
I mean, obviously, qualified sense of free will or whatever, but I think so. I guess it also depends on what you're meaning by free will too, right? So I don't think it leads to an absolute determinism just because we're treating humans as part of nature. For example, that we have evolved or something, right? So similar to Darwin, you know, just because we have evolved doesn't mean we lose any of our own, things that we have been noticing about ourselves for years and years. It just means that we kind of need to look at that data differently, you know, if that, you know, that theory is correct, right? So same thing with Marx's theory. If his theory is correct, you know, we're just looking at the data of humans as kind of part of nature, but as something that this is my editorializing again, but as something that we can recognize as created, given certain mental processes, you know, as something that is a work of humans. But I don't think that's like, I guess I'm liking the Spinoza view in that, like, you know, we always want to give humans like the advantage over every other animal in the animal kingdom or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And I've always found that to be a strange argument. It's just like saying the Browns are the best team, you know, like my team is the best team, you know, and so you should always be suspect when you claim that, you know, humans have it the best, or we are able to interpret humans better than we can other animals. I certainly think they have a level of consciousness and intelligence, and they create things too. It's, you know, whatever, you know.
First of all, to compare Spinoza's materialism to Darwin's is worth doing. And one of the things that I think is interesting about Spinoza's materialism is that it's fundamentally a religious category. That from Spinoza, the mind and the body or the mind and matter are extensions of God.
Right. Yeah.
And that you know, there are different domains within a universal pantheistic God.
Mm-hmm.
So Spinoza had no conception of evolution along the lines of Darwin. His materialism, such as it was not the same as Darwin's.
Okay. Yeah.
Because Darwin's conception of like natural history was not that was not minded in the same way that Spinoza's was. I mean, Spinoza, there was a God that was extending itself through the universe and developing. Mm-hmm. Materially, and I'm not sure even if there was change.
No. Hold on. Certainly, like, Spinoza's philosophy captures change. In fact, on some level, like Deleuze or whatever, it thinks of himself as a Spinozist. And in fact, all there is change. You get lost in Spinoza when you start saying there are these, like, you know, stationary beings, right? Like, or Deleuze, for example, you get lost in Deleuze if say there's some stationary beings. And so like you want to believe in your thoughts that, there are these stable beings, but, you know, you have to actually go out into the world. You have to take your thoughts and go out into the world and discover what there actually is. Right. And so the natural processes in Spinoza are all very much allowed. In fact, I mean, it's almost so the way I look at Spinoza is almost like a precursor to Kantianism, like where, you know, you realize that you have to conform the objects to your ability to capture them, right? So, like, there's a certain amount of view in those objects that you're perceiving, right? Or there's certain limitations of how well you can perceive them, and that is based on you. So a similar thing, so it's not stated like that in Spinoza, but, I mean, Spinoza's, like, second kind of knowledge, the second kind of knowledge is basically scientific knowledge. Yeah, I mean, so the first kind of knowledge is just, like, our ability to have imaginations, like, you know, fantasies and or dreams, but also your real life, those, like, sensory, you know, things coming in through your senses, that's all first kind of knowledge. That's stuff that you can rely on, but it's not the same thing as knowledge where you are clear and distinct. So you can hear the Descartes in there. So clear and distinct is the science. So it's more like science, right? It's more like we've gone out, we've discovered it, we've double blind tested it, and we're as certain as we're going to ever get, right, on it, right? And then Spinoza has another level of knowledge that comes after you get to that second kind of knowledge. And only a few people kind of make it to that. And that is sort of like a moral equivalent of wisdom, right? So you have good knowledge of how your body interacts with the world, how other bodies interact in the world. And mind you, this is like kind of wiped clean of a lot of your imaginations. However, you still have your imaginations. They're still part of the world. They're still, you know, part of your body. So with this intuitive, like, wisdom type of knowledge, you get sort of like beyond the scientific. Like, you're able to make progresses and like increase your power, and, you know, not be so frustrated, and, you know, be so subject to your emotions, and it's sort of like the get beyond on all of that. So yeah. If I can relate this to Marx.
Okay, let me just jump in and say, okay, yeah. So first of all, there are two parts to what you just said. I just want to see if I understand them both and maybe object to something there. The first thing was I had said that I wasn't sure that Spinoza could even had a theory of history or historical change, or I could cope with change at all. Now, you pointed out that, you know, Deleuze embraced Spinoza, and that that for Deleuze, there was nothing but change, and that's been, and really Spinoza embraced something similar. Then you moved into an explanation of Spinoza's epistemology, which I think may be separate from this first question about whether Spinoza had a theory of history and could cope with change. What's the relationship between Spinoza and someone like Heraclitus? I know that Deleuze was interested in Heraclitus. Mm-hmm. Was Spinoza, do you know?
I didn't catch, like, so I, when I think of Heraclitus, I almost think of, like, he says a bunch of, like, cones or whatever, you know, like meditational devices or something that involve that the whole world is flux, right?
Right. So Heraclitus is making, like, an ontological claim, not very, you know, not in any sort of systematic way, but he's making an argument, like Thales was arguing that the universe was water, Parmenides was saying the universe is one unchanging substance, Heraclitus was saying the universe is a constant flux, it is fire or change.
Right. So having read through the book, I certainly think that we're talking Spinoza now would be more on the lines of, you know, things are more stable than that, that they aren't just flux. However, I mean, I think the epistemology is linked. So to kind of respond to that comment, I think that you get, once you see that the most powerful position is to limit yourself to the confines of your knowledge or your ability. I mean, I'm sounding Kantian here because I think there's a deep connection between the two, but like the limits of your ability to, you know, like you have these imaginations, but that is limitless in a way that is unfounded, right? And so, like, I mean, yeah, as far as like the actual ontology of Spinoza, I think that like when you go in, like I didn't pay a lot of attention to like the God stuff, right? So he talks a lot about like kind of who God is or what God is and all of that. So I think that question might be answered better there, but I didn't get the sense that it would be an equivalent of fire. Now Deleuze, I would say, would be a big fan of Heraclitus and, you know, would say that there is this kind of, you know, ever-changing, ever-adapting plane of you know, how we're considering things and how we, if you're part of a mass crowd, you're different than just regular Doug, right? There's two different beings there almost completely. So it's not that the whole world is in flux as much as, but like what level of you know, power you can exhibit does change. And, you know, in that change, there's.
So just to go back to Darwin for a second, but what's interesting, yeah. I think here's the thing about Spinoza and Deleuze's version of Heraclitus and the fact that you brought in epistemology into the question is all of that is a significant and significantly different from Darwin. Darwin, I think, from my limited understanding of Darwin's theory of evolution, Darwin doesn't require for there to be any minds at all for this to work.
Okay.
You could have robots and that never develop consciousness and explain their evolution with Darwin's theory.
I mean, the problem with that statement is that I would actually agree with you, but that's any kind of science. Like you're just saying, if I'm going to jump into Spinoza's shoes again, that God is unchanging, right? And that would be true. Like, so Darwin's theory, if true, describes a world that is, you know, God, right? Like it is nature, is all of nature and is on some sort of determined progression. Or something
I'm doing is making a claim about Darwin. I'm not making any claims about God or Spinoza here.
No. But I'm trying to jump back into that because that's kind of the framework of the studies that I've been doing. But Darwin I think once again, you have to have that mental layer of appreciating that Marx and Darwin are putting forward a theory on how to organize the information that you are receiving, right? And so the information once organized, you know, appears to be like true no matter if humans are around or not. That's great, but I think the reason we find the theory interesting is because it's you know. A way of organizing the world that seems better than maybe just, you know, waking up and walking out in the world and wondering why, you know, things are happening the way they are or something. I don't know if that's.
Well, okay. So, right. I mean, what I heard you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I heard you saying is sort of a refutation of a strict materialism. What you're saying is, look, even if you hold a theory that's completely materialist and doesn't require there to even be such a thing as a mind. In order for you to hold it, you have to have a mind. Your theory kind of refutes itself. Is that part of what you're saying?
I mean, yeah, basically. I mean, like, basically, the theory can be true and all of that can be true, but the reason we're making theory is because we don't actually know.
Right. So I don't disagree with you there, okay? Again, my point was just that that Darwin's theory of evolution doesn't speak to really the problem of minds, and the reason why it is a natural history is because it doesn't, and it has a completely mechanical explanation of how life evolved on the planet.
Okay,
so. For there to be a Darwinian, now I get back into the Marx, kind of a Darwinian explanation of human history,
mm-hmm.
where I think we have to look for something that's similar to Darwin's theory, but it's in some weird way fundamentally different. And Darwin's theory of evolution is based on the survival of the fittest. Basically, mutations that happen to be advantageous for an organism's reproductive success will continue. Mm-hmm. You know, and those that aren't will be eliminated, and that's it. That's what drives evolution, that principle of mutation and survival and reproduction. So we want to look for something like that in Marx, as he's going to give us a materialist accounting of history. And I think what we're going to find at the heart of it is actually not as simple as the Darwinian accounting of. I think that there's going to be what's different about it is that what is driving history is changed by the subjects of history.
Well, okay, so if we go back to what you're saying about Darwin, I mean, the only thing I would kind of say to that is that, like, similar to what we're talking about with Marx, I mean, the theoretical point of it might be simple, but, you know, his all of his work and all of the continuing work is on the actual historical progression of that thing, right? So the reason, like, this chapter is supposed to be sort of like this chapter in Marx is supposed to be similar to Darwin, is that you're starting with kind of the actual historical places that we started and then developed into. And the same thing happens with Darwin, is the basic theory gets unfolded, you know, through time, as much as they can discover things that, you know, back up the theory, right? So, like the theory doesn't
right,
have
right.
To be
I mean, Darwin's theory doesn't need to be complex. I'm not saying there's anything deficient about it for what it's explaining. I'm just saying it, and clearly tracking. And the way that genetically mutations have been able to reproduce, and what the process of evolution is, and seeing all the levels to it, because it's not simple in terms of like it's not a simple thing like you're either a mutation that helps or you're a mutation that doesn't help. That isn't really what happens, right? I mean, there's mutations that are advantageous in some ways and disadvantageous. Create a disadvantage and then another way. And so, yeah, then just proving the theory to be true is a lot of empirical work and hard work. It's an incredibly complicated theory, evolutionary theory. And the people who are evolutionary biologists are, you know, much brighter than I am. Probably and have a huge array of understanding and knowledge behind them. I'm not putting that down. I'm just saying that the principle of it is rather simple, and it doesn't right. and it doesn't talk to or speak to a theory of mind or a theory of values, or like you can't use evolutionary theory to find out what is moral, for instance. You know, you can only find out what has reproduced.
Okay. Yeah. Certainly. I agree with all of what you said.
A materialist counting of human history is just not going to be the same as a materialist accounting of what we call natural history, or a truly Darwinian accounting of evolution. That there's a something new introduced here, which was human activity in human in the human mind.
Let's just say that when you add these human layers, you're on a level that is more complex just by nature, like just by its nature. Like I'm still holding on to that, like it's all natural processes. Even the things that humans do are really just natural processes. And so they're just more complex natural processes.
Okay, now we need to just kind of crack open this idea of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, ask ourselves does your conception of nature, like Spinoza's, include a conception of consciousness or mind or God? And if it does, will you admit that a materialist accounting of nature doesn't, a strictly materialist accounting of nature doesn't include those concepts?
I would find that whatever theory didn't include mind to be rather inadequate, you know, like even on the material level, like, hey, those, you know, primates have, you know, complex behaviors or whatever. I mean, even if you described it in a behaviorist manner,
But a strictly behaviorist accounting doesn't include mind. That's why it's a behaviorist accounting.
Okay.
That's what behaviorism is an accounting of human behavior on the level of empirical observation alone, and not including motivation, subjectivity and motivation and mind.
So,
you are accounting for mind by eliminating it with behaviorism. The same is true with materialism in general. I think that strict materialism, not dualism, but strict materialism, it doesn't have any room for mind.
Hello there. I am Professor Nash, and welcome to my class. I know you may be thinking, what is behaviorism? Let me make it more simple. Behaviorism is a type of psychology and a theory of learning. Everything we know about behaviorism is through observation and experimentation. It is not concerned with internal thoughts like thinking or emotions. What behaviorists believe is that people have no free will. Our surroundings and environments determine our behavior.
So he's not just writing a book of science here. Marx is not writing just a book of science. He's also writing a book that's trying to motivate people and kind of cause an ebb and flow in the systems that he's seeing. I mean, right now we're still in a very descriptive, but even in this chapter, there is rhetoric in there. You know, there's stuff that, like, why are we talking about these particular facts versus others, right? And I don't think he's wrong. I think you can't get too far away from the fact that he's trying to be convincing as well, you know, on a level of the social and not just individuals, because at that level, we don't have a lot of knowledge. It's very easy to only see your family and your friends and not think about anything beyond that, right?
So what you're saying here, what you're sneaking in here, is that Karl Marx was as interested in convincing people what he was saying was true as he was of discovering the truth, that he was not an impartial theorist, that he didn't have any claim to objectivity here. But you would also say that of, I think you could say that same thing of Darwin.
Yeah, well, I mean, Darwin, I'm not well versed in the actual writings, but certainly people didn't believe, and he had a lot of work to do, and still does, which surprises me. But, like, as well as the theory has, you know, panned out over 100 years. But there's still people that, like, grumble when you say his name, but I think, you know, beyond that work of just convincing people to take a look through his, you know, his periscope or whatever you want to, like, whatever those machines are, where you, not just periscope, actually the picture boxes where you, like, you could slide the camera, a little kid's toy, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, like if you look, he's like, look here, you know, and I think the same thing that Marx is doing is saying, look here. So there is a convincing, I think there's less so with Darwin, but maybe I'm wrong, than I see with Marx, because Marx, it is a talking about people and talking to convince people. But so, yeah, I think there is, but I don't think that's wrong necessarily. But that's the other thing you have to, like, think about, is that this thing is all in motion. You know, we're not just taking a picture of it and describing the picture, especially with the historical materialism, especially in Marx, is that the next step has a question mark on it on some level, right? You know, like the future beyond. Once we've described it fully, there's a question mark. Like, what will the next thing?
Well, I see. I think here's the difference between what you're saying and what Marx would say, is that we actually can determine the what kinds of answers we're going to get in this kind of system. I strongly want to like set up an understanding of what the issue is in chapter 15. And it's really goes, it's been throughout all of Capital, but I feel like if you are not on board with Marx by this point in the in Capital, that you might just react to this chapter as sort of a little shrill and dated, right? It's like you could go, oh, look at all the things that people who, when they worked in factories, had to live with. And we certainly, it's lucky that capitalism's developed away from that. Marx is explaining something else here, too. He's explaining how the creation of value created the conditions for machines to arise and was changed by the development of machines. But he's also saying this is all nasty and it's not nearly that nasty now. And
well, so to say something to that, like, so when you read it along the lines of Darwin, then you can, and as a historical movement from here to here, and you realize that in order for it to be nice like it is now, I mean, we've moved our factories to places where we can't see them. I mean, that is one of the biggest moves that a capitalist has done, is taking those factories with those horrible conditions where you had kids working and whatever, and you move them somewhere else, right? And so you can't see them. So, you know, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And so what if some people in India or Bangladesh or China are suffering? You know, that's up to their government to protect their people.
But
yeah,
but the question remains, has the capitalist done this just out of, I mean, do we agree with Marx that these kinds of results are, if not absolutely determined, like a billiard ball, one billiard ball hitting another, causal chain determined, mm-hmm. but are conditioned by value production and the exploitation that this kind of commodity exchange necessitates? Or do we not believe that and just think that this is sort of that maybe what's happening is the nastiness is slowly being squeezed to the margins, and then as, you know, these other countries develop, then that will be eliminated there as well? And
so the nastiness of this, I don't think he's arguing that that's historically necessary. I think that it is historically a fact, and that it did develop that way. I don't get that because it did happen that way, that every time that, you know, let's just say everything was wiped out and then people, you know, people grew all the way back up again, right? And then the next time they, you know, get to this point where they're technologically innovating, that they would necessarily have to be, I mean, they could be a Star Trek circumstance where a totally different society did it differently because we weren't driven by the same principles, or they wouldn't allow certain things to have happened the way that they did.
Yeah. You know, okay. I mean, but this, again, this is really important because the what would be different and, the way that it did develop, you know, historically, and I'll just say under capitalism, and some alternative technological development that leads to something like we see on Star Trek, what would have to change according to Marx?
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, so
no, that's a question.
No. For you. I know. Yeah. I mean, so I don't know what Marx, you said according to Marx, so you added that at the end. But
I mean, in this chapter, what would, I mean, we can say based on what's in this chapter, just the first four sections that I've seen, we can say what would have to change for these conditions not to be the case in some future technological development.
Are you saying that there would be a lack of greed or something?
No. Okay. No, I'm not saying that there would be a lack of greed. What would change is whether or not the technology was put to use for the production of commodities, you know, whether or not therefore also the capitalist class existed, and then whether or not it was seeking a surplus through production and the exploitation of labor.
I mean, I see what you're saying, right? So because it's, I mean, I still want to call it greed, but okay. So because it's the capitalist class that are interested in exchange value, have lost interest in the use value on some level, other than to know that they can exchange, this class of people who are driven by this, I still think that those same people could be, okay, let's say governmental controls, although he does talk negatively about governmental controls, it was kind of like gaming, you know, like the capitalists are gaming that too in order to squeeze out competition. But I think that, like, let's just say that the people just were just fundamentally different, and that the society wouldn't take these kind of kids just don't go to, you know, like modern times, kids just don't go to the factory. It just doesn't, you know, doesn't happen. We believe in childhood, like your Robin Hood book. You know, that's important, right? Or not Robin Hood, Robin Milne, yeah. Robin book.
Yeah, right. Yeah. A. Milne.
I didn't think of that in the background here, is that you know, childhood is...
Christopher Robin,
let's see it. That childhood is in the background here, hasn't been invented yet, right? So like kids are in factories and are really thought of having to earn their own and help out wherever they can. I don't think that the capitalism has to be exploitative. It's ultimately a position that, like, I still fundamentally believe, and I haven't seen proven wrong in this chapter, not in the previous
one. So you haven't been convinced by the last 15 chapters of Capital that there's anything inherently exploitative about capitalism.
I agree with Marx from what I've read that historically it has been, but that just the move to exchanging things, I don't think you have to be exploitative. I mean,
you were unconvinced by the first couple of chapters of Capital.
Right, right.
But so now the question is, if you weren't unconvinced by those couple of chapters, would you understand why Marx argues? I mean, you understand that Marx is arguing that this is inherently exploitative, not just that it happens to be historically, and that he's doing it based on his understanding of what a commodity is, which starts out all of Capital. But I mean, do you disagree with that?
Do I disagree that Marx is arguing that Marx believes it?
That's the argument in the book.
I certainly think that's his point of view. And he, like I said, I do think that his arguments are convincing, as far as my knowledge on this, which is very weak.
When you say his arguments in chapter 15, or you mean the arguments in chapters 1 and 2?
Oh, I thought we were talking about up to the point I've read.
Yeah, so 1 through 15.
Let's say 1 through 14 and, you know, halfway through 15. Yeah. You know, up to this point, I do think that, yeah, he's thinking historically this manifested in a very exploitative way. Now, I've yet to see him say, and it will only continue to develop in this way, right? So that I have not yet seen. So that part of the argument I've not yet
had. He would never want to say that, right? I mean, that's not what he wants to say. He doesn't want to say that technological development or history will always continue in this one way. But he does, at the beginning of Capital, talk about how the production of a commodity for exchange leads us to understand that there is such a thing called value. And then that led us to understand why capitalists produce for exchange rather than use, and what the difference between MCM and CMC is, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what's going on in this chapter, I think you have to keep all those things in mind when you read it. It's not just that he's cataloging historical facts without explanation. And so going back to what you said earlier, you remain unconvinced that capitalism has to be exploitative. That means that you are unconvinced by the arguments early on in Capital. Because they are there, that he does make those arguments. Maybe they're not good arguments, but he makes those arguments early on in Capital.
I guess maybe I'm getting lost in the shuffle of, if we're talking about it's fundamentally versus like it's fundamentally starting that way, and you know where it is going to, it maybe is different, but like I don't think that just because we're developing something for exchange and we, our whole life is bound up in that one item, for example, like, so, you know, we are producing, my little island is producing one thing. And if no one decided to exchange with anymore, we would, you know, not have all of our other living, you know, food, shelter, whatever, you know, we're just producing wheels and that's, you know, which is basically the state that we're at now. Right. And a large chunk of this chapter is talking about these islands, basically, we'll call them, I'll call it an island of just like these workers, when the machinery takes over, have like nothing to fall back on. And maybe a really cheap, you know, they just end up cheapening a labor force that was already, you know, let's say fully instantiated. Maybe they were looking for some laborers, but now they were looking for one and now they have 100 applicants. So that just drives their own labor down now even worse, right? So you have these kind of weird islands that get created by this production. And so like that part of it, and you know, that we're like burning through resources in order to churn out that one thing. And then when the resources is gone, everybody packs up and leaves. And then, you know, what happens to that particular place? I mean, those type of things, I don't know I think that's going to be kind of fundamental.
For the worker, it's the case that what he relies on now for his subsistence is not merely his labor power, but also the apparatus, the machine, right? In this chapter. But overall in our society, we're not on islands. We have societies which are jammed full of production of all sorts of different things. We have farms and we have, you know, roads and we have all sorts of different material supports in our world. The difference there between this and like pre-capitalist society is that in pre-capitalist society, every person had, or, you know, most all people, except for slaves, had some approach to life where they could, through their own labor, produce everything they needed for themselves. Mm-hmm. And that has gone away. That has largely gone away. I mean, there's still subsistence farmers, there's still peasants in the world and things, but that's mostly been eliminated. So now we are all kind of, even in a world full of abundance, where we are separated out and, you know, we don't, each individual has to find a place in this machine called capitalism in order to continue. No one of us can go off. It's very difficult to just go off in the woods and live on your own. You know? But that's not the same thing. Even that is not really, that's just like a consequence of stuff that Marx argues earlier in the book, that all this happening is a consequence of setting up that exchange relationship as the primary relationship in the world, done for, you know, to create in basically, it's a mode of production to create value, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I feel like it's important to remind ourselves of that initial couple of chapters and the initial arguments about value as we go through these other parts of the book. And that's why I wanted to bring up the fact that it was not strictly just a materialist reading. It was like Darwin's was, that it was telling us something about how we as human beings create our world subjectively. And the weird thing was that we do it objectively, that we create our own objective conditions. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of, you know, it's back to this Hegelian dialectical thing, but you know, I again, just because I'm very adamantly saying we have to remember this doesn't mean that we have to accept it, right? I mean, there, you know, Spinoza said what he said, and it's important to remember what Spinoza said and get what he said right when we're discussing him. And neither one of us are probably great at doing that. But then accepting him and knowing what he actually argued are two different things. You can understand what Spinoza argued and understand his argument without accepting it, I think. I'm not even sure about that, but
no, yeah, probably, yeah. I mean, so, and that's where I'm. I mean, so theory in general, and then this Marx reading, and maybe even the Hegel. You know, the point of it for me is to have read the book, to have done my best to understand it, you know, to the best of my ability, and less on the side of, you know, what Marx would want me to do is either be convinced or not convinced, right? So I don't go into it thinking I need to be convinced or not convinced, but I go into it more on the I'd like to be educated.
See, I think you do need to be either convinced or not convinced in order to understand the argument. Because if you don't ask yourself, am I convinced, then, and you're not trying to figure out whether or not you agree, then you don't know whether the argument is really working.
Oh, no, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, I balance this stuff off of how does it fit with my life? Does it, you know, like, so... when I say I'm not going to be convinced, what I mean is I'm not immediately going to be convinced by it. That I'm going to read it, understand it, and then walk with it for a certain period of time. And in that period of time that I walk with it, you know, you kind of build arguments, your own arguments for it or against what you've read. You know, you see the little pieces. I mean, there's certainly it's a well-written book. It's a historically significant book. And just those facts alone means that everybody should probably attempt it, you know, get a flavor for it, if nothing else. But like the arguments themselves, I mean, up to this point, as a reasonable human being who really doesn't know anything about economics or anything like that, I think it's convincing. Like it is a convincing. If you let me use Deleuze or whatever, it's a convincing plateau to stand from. Like, I don't know beyond that plateau of what I've read that it fits all circumstances. But while I'm like having the book out and while I'm walking around the world, it seems to fit okay. Like, I'm not getting like a lot of feedback.
See, I'm real reluctant to embrace this idea of this convincing plateau. And here, let me tell you why. The other night, I was talking to my son, Ben, who's 19 now and much smarter than I am. And that's why he's not on the podcast anymore, is because I don't want to be shown up. But he was explaining calculus to me, and he was explaining, maybe it wasn't even calculus, it was algebra. I don't know what he was explaining. So we were looking at irrational numbers. And he was explaining to me how you could understand that they are, in fact, irrational. He was kind of proving to me that what looks like just a decimal with a long string of places is actually an infinite number that's irrational and can't do some of the things that whole numbers or rational numbers can do. And so I saw all this, and he made pretty convincing cases, and we actually did some algebra together. And at the end of it, I said, well, Christ, I have to go read Pythagoras, because I didn't like the way irrational numbers made me feel. You know, I felt like, no, the universe cannot contain these irrational numbers. This is somehow a violation of my sense of order and propriety. And I wanted to go back to Pythagoras to, you know, but I mean, obviously I was sort of poking fun at myself, but I did have this emotional reaction. It was sort of disturbing to recognize what an irrational number was. That would be, if I were, deploying this notion of a plateau of comfortable experience with an argument, I would not be on that plateau with irrational numbers. I would be saying no to that. And I would be saying yes to Pythagoras, that would be a good plateau for me. Even if it wasn't true, this is a good plateau for me to take a view of the world, because I was comfortable with the arguments that Pythagoras is making. They didn't, you know what I'm saying? So now.
Yeah. I mean, so I want to respond to that. So it's a perfect example, right? So like your son is going to be able to do, let's just say it was calculus, right? Like, he's going to be able to explain the motions of the planets, right? I think that's when they developed calculus, and that was the problem they were trying to solve. And maybe I'm wrong, but this kind of, when you throw the ball up, it doesn't just go up and then down, which is what everybody thought happened. But you're actually able to come up with a math problem as to the motion and the line and the curve that it goes on, right? So that's vaguely, if my memory of calculus is that's vaguely what they're doing in calculus. Well, Doug, when you go back to Pythagoras, you're just saying, I will not be able to explain the route of that ball, and you're just saying that's okay, right? And then, you know, you're going back to your rational numbers, and I mean, and then on some level, outside of theory, there is no such thing as numbers.
Yeah, but you got to keep in mind that Pythagoras didn't just, I mean, Pythagoras was confronted with irrational numbers. Okay, Pythagoras didn't, it wasn't like he couldn't do the math. He could. He rejected it, and he killed a man over it. He was like, no, my cult is going to, we cannot let this heresy out that there are irrational numbers in the world. So it was not so much a limit of ability to reason. It was reasoning through to something, finding it unacceptable, and then saying no to it. And
No, so what I mean by the limit is that going forward, whatever power, aka knowledge, that you have with knowing calculus, you're just saying that knowledge is not, that power is not something that I am a wanting, desiring, and so therefore your life is
sure. Yeah, that's right.
It's just better on this plane where that just those questions and answers you they're not available to you.
No, listen, I completely agree with you. If we use the criteria of power and an acceptance of a loss of power and utility as a justification for belief or disbelief in something. In other words, if you're willing to say, look, no, I because of my discomfort with this theory, I'm simply going to give up the power of knowledge that it would give me and stay within this much more comfortable realm of illusion. Yeah, that's right. You can do that. But
it wouldn't even be illusion. It would just be a limitations. But however, with this cooperation that we've got in Marx, you, Doug Lane, don't have to know about calculus. As long as somebody knows about calculus and you can hire him successfully, and then you can explain exactly whatever that.
See, once you're confronted with the argument, once your kid sits you down at 2 o'clock in the morning, or it was like 1 o'clock at night actually, and does the math with you, at the kitchen table. And you follow each step, you're no longer in a state of ignorance. You're not accepting a state of ignorance. You're rejecting a state of knowledge.
Right, as being unattainable to you at whatever age and plus.
No, I just didn't like it. It wasn't that I didn't attain it. I did. I understood each step of it. I saw that there was irrational numbers. I would probably need to be able to really fully grasp, but I need to go through it a couple more times. But I, right. In that moment, I did understand it, and I didn't like it, and wanted to become, you know, jokingly wanted to become a Pythagoras because I didn't like how it felt to have irrational numbers in my little head. But that doesn't mean that I had, if I used my own affective experience as my guide and my own subjective desires as my guide as to what kinds of knowledge systems I'm going to embrace, then I was perfectly within my rights to embrace Pythagoras. But it would involve rejecting a reasonable argument, which I saw to be reasonable, that mm-hmm. that would be involved.
For right. So you're just letting emotions, which is not a sense of knowledge at all, but it's emotions is just a, something else is having an affect on you. I'm sorry to use, I tried really hard not to say that word, but, is having an affect on you that has maybe, you know, maybe the last time you learned this, somebody was about to beat you up and you had this like,
No, it wasn't that. I mean, it was something about the way, I mean, it was not that I had some irrational association with the, you know, irrational numbers. It wasn't like, it was that irrational numbers were consequential for my whole view of the world as I understood the world in a way that really I couldn't quite predict what the full implication was. It didn't fit, and it was going to require me to do a lot more thinking that I hadn't done yet to fully integrate into my view of the world. Just so what the consequences of irrational numbers were. I mean, I could see the reasons were solid, but I didn't know what the consequences were going to be, really. And it felt like someone had taken a hammer to the lens of my camera when I got these irrational numbers. And so it wasn't because it was actually the argument itself had this affect. It wasn't some association with some past trauma or something. It was traumatic itself to have a piece of information come in that makes you have to re-examine and reformulate.
I mean, and that's the fundamental, position of like Nietzsche or somebody, right? So I had to get him in there too, right? Is that there are truths that people just do not want to stomach, right? And that are just kind of beyond their own ability to control. And that's why you fall back on a fiction like, Pythagoras is better. And that made you feel very comfortable. You didn't have to swallow the big fact that, maybe you didn't. Okay, so you're saying you understood it, but you couldn't reproduce it. You couldn't articulate it,
I can articulate to a degree,
but you recognize. So I mean, I'm trying not to psychologize, but I think that the biggest thing that was affecting you was that it was going to take a lot of work to get to the point where, and it wasn't worth it, and but to get to the point where you could functionally have a conversation with a mathematician, and it just wasn't.
It's also this problem of infinity.
Okay,
so it was not just that it was going to require me to do a lot of work before I could comfortably talk to a mathematician about it. That's true. But it also meant that on some level or another, there was solid argumentation for infinity being real, having not just like a vague abstract way, but that it could be specifically real, that there was an irrational infinite number that was possible to calculate out to an infinite. I mean, if we had an infinite amount of time, we could calculate it out to an infinite decimal and never stop. And that was emerging out of simply the square root of 3.
Since rational numbers are closed under all 4 arithmetic operations, addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, you might think that rational numbers finally represent a complete collection of numbers. We can add, subtract, multiply, and divide, and never have a problem representing the result.
Yay!
This is what the Greeks thought as well. That is, until they discovered an inconvenient truth. That there are certain types of quantities that cannot be represented by rational numbers. Nobody knows exactly who made this disturbing discovery. It may have been the great Greek mathematician Pythagoras, but legend has it was one of his students, who was subsequently killed for upsetting the apple cart with this discovery. Numbers were obviously a sensitive subject for the Pythagoreans. The proof of the existence of irrational numbers may have gone something like this. If rational numbers can represent any quantity, then they should be able to represent square roots. Now, the definition of rational numbers says that any rational number can be represented as the ratio of 2 integers. In other words, one integer which we will call p divided by another which we will call q. P over Q is obviously a fraction, and like any fraction, we can write it in its simplest form so that the integers P and Q have no common factors. We also know that since the square root of 2 is not an integer, the denominator Q is some number other than 1. Now, since the square root of 2 and the quantity P over Q are equal, then we can square them both and they will still be equal. The square root of 2 squared is 2, and the quantity p over q squared is p over q times p over q, or p times p over q times q. For this fraction to be equal to 2, we must somehow be able to reduce it to 2 over 1. But we already saw that q was not 1. So the only other way this fraction could be equal to 2 over 1 is to cancel out common factors in the numerator and the denominator. But we also said that P and Q have no common factors. Therefore, there are no factors in the numerator that are the same as any factor in the denominator. So we can't cancel any factors, and there is no way that this fraction can be equal to 2. Therefore, this is an impossible situation. Our original assumption that the square root of 2 can be represented by the ratio of two integers must be wrong. The square root of 2 must be some value, which is not a rational number.
Like it or not, I'm going to probably have to let infinite numbers into my life and realize that if I, you know, that they exist. I mean, I don't necessarily have to do anything with them. I don't have to try to understand anything more about them. I do now, because of my son, have to accept that they are there. And as uncomfortable as it makes me, I can't seriously retreat to Pythagoras. I can joke about it, but I can't really do it. And I don't think that, I think that if you read Marx and you want to not believe him, you have to think, you may not be right, but you have to find an argument that seems to discredit him. You can't just say, I don't believe him because I just don't. And I don't, you know, I unless you don't understand, you know, unless you just put an argument out of your mind or something. If I had stopped my son from going through it the third time, because we went through it three times, I could have just remained in my ignorance without even knowing I had made that choice.
Right. Yeah.
So,
I agree. So there's two different levels, right? So there's the one level where, you decide, okay, I've been exposed to these new ideas, let's say Marx, and I'm just going to put it out of my mind, find something, some other, you know, dragon to chase and slay. But then you have to allow the fact that there's Marxists and you can't say anything to them, right? You know, like, they get to continue on doing their thing, and they could be right, right? So I agree with you that the ultimate positionality is to have a good argument against those people, or at least a way of accepting and incorporating his insights without accepting the maybe all of the conclusions. I mean, I think that's the point of reading philosophy, is that you can incorporate the things that do kind of fit and allow the other ones to be pursued by other people, hoping that, you know, in the same way, hoping your son develops an understanding of calculus and can solve problems that you can't solve. And in the same way, I regard like arguments that I can't solve, don't want to solve. I don't begrudge the people that pursue them further, and I don't necessarily want to prove them wrong. I want them to be right. I just, you know, like, I think the Browns are going to lose on Sunday. It's just because 9 times out of 10, they do lose on Sunday. And so, like, you know, just being practical about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't feel this way about Marx yet, but like, there's certain theories out there that I have little faith that they're going to succeed, you know, just because they don't seem to be proving out in my own studies on the matter. But,
Okay. So here's the way I approach all this stuff is like, I have found when I was an undergraduate at Portland State and I studied philosophy, what I found was that every theory that came along would have very serious objections to it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that because of those objections, I would never be able to fully embrace the totality of a theory. Like, Cartesianism has some very serious objections when it comes to his dualism and the mind-body interaction that I don't think Descartes ever overcomes. There's very serious objections to hedonism as an ethical theory, or utilitarianism as an ethical theory, that I don't think that utilitarian theorists ever overcome. The same is true of Kantian universalism. There are some very serious objections to that kind of ethical theory that I don't think that Kant overcomes. If I haven't found those objections to an argument, then I remain convinced.
Okay.
That I don't feel that I can reject an argument based on the possibility of it being wrong or feeling counterintuitive. I feel like I have to accept the argument being right until I find the... that's how I try to behave philosophically. I don't universally behave that way about all things. You know, but when I'm being philosophically rigorous or rational, which I'm not always, but when I am, that's how I try to behave. I try to say, okay, if there's a serious objection I can see, then I'll reject it. Then I will at least reject it for now, you know, until it's overcome. I just feel like that's not a very controversial approach to philosophy or to reason itself, but that it is very difficult to maintain. One of my serious objections to Caffeine and Deleuze, who to me are the same person at this point, I only know Deleuze really through Caffeine, who I really like and, you know, love to have a beer with when he comes to the town, if he ever does again. One of my serious objections to him is that he does not approach philosophy in this way, that he tries to leave room, not even that this seems to be the major point of a lot of what Caffeine does when it comes to working with Deleuze, is leave room for there to be a completely different set of criteria, that it's not a matter of serious objections based on incoherence or, you know, problems with the math or whatever, that just based on affect or other sets of criteria, or simply the fact that the possibility for plenty is still available to us and that kind of thing, that he has a different way of approaching philosophical arguments, which basically goes back to the sophists, you know. And my problem is that I have this serious objection, but I keep coming back to him because, first of all, it's fun to talk to him, but also I'm not sure yet how serious my objection is. And because he's arguing differently, it's very, very difficult to win him over or get him to see that irrational numbers exist or whatever, you know? I can't get to that final, like, aha thing. It's always – he always is slipping away over here. So that's always fun too. Go ahead.
I can say that, I mean, the reason why this conversation, similar conversations – I mean, if I agreed with everything that you said – then it would not make a good conversation. You know, like it would just be, hail Doug, or something.
I think that would be a great conversation. What's wrong with you to think that would be bad?